Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, reporting every week on a variety of outlets. I was the first health reporter on the Huffington Post, where I broke the story on fracking, also covering that and other issues that affect our health, that arise from our society, and that affect our planet and our habitat, planet Earth here, covering that on Alternate, EcoWatch, and a host of other sites, including upcoming iFlip4, a new millennial site. Every week on this show, we connect the dots between everything that affects our health and well-being and our total that arises in our total environment. There are a lot of shows out there and a lot of books and a lot of information on what you can do as an individual. This show addresses what we can do as a society. It enlists people to activism and action and getting involved in all of the different issues that really impact us that arise from societal and business decisions and policies so that we can make our voices heard. And that's what we do every week on Connect the Dots. We have a range of authors, experts, advocates, doctors, thought leaders, and this week I am delighted to say that we have a visionary joining us. So thrilled to have him here. This is Jerry Mander, who will be on the show along with another special guest, which we'll talk about in a little. And those of you who are regular listeners will know that for the last month, and this will be our fourth program, I've been featuring a teach-in on Techno-Utopia, which happened last weekend and was started was initiated by the International Forum on Globalization. Jerry Mander is the co-chair of that organization. He's the former program director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology, and he really has been a visionary in that he's been far ahead of the curve in identifying, analyzing, and seeking solutions for some of the outscale problems that we're having today. I attended the teach-in last weekend. It was absolutely fabulous. We're going to be bringing a lot, many more speakers and experts from that event to Connect the Dots in coming weeks and months, I'm happy to say. Last May, we did an entire month on Trans-Pacific Partnership and other global trade agreements. So, you know, when we get into these kind of big-picture realms that a lot of people, myself included, aren't that well informed about, we try to go in with enough breadth and depth to really kind of understand what's happening. And we also are going to be keeping tabs on the evolution of the trade treaties, because with the upcoming lamed up Congress after the election, we're expecting there may be some sudden sneaky moves back then, so we may be in Congress to quickly try to pass something, as there's been a lot of secrecy around those agreements. So we'll be coming back as well to keep you informed about that topic. Today we're really going to get a big picture, thanks to Jerry Mander. He'll be talking about the role of globalization and global economics, what's inherently flawed in that and problematic for us. And this is the kind of topic I love to do on Connect the Dots, because it's really big picture thinking. Don't let it scare you. Don't feel that it's too outsized to kind of try to get our hands around, because that's what we're going to try to do. Jerry is the author of a groundbreaking, infamous book. It was published in 1978, called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. And the fact that it's still available on Amazon tells you a lot about the incredible impact of that book. I personally read it as a graduate student in film school. So imagine you're studying and learning television and going into the world of reporting and journalism, and you're reading a book that basically argues that we have a technology with very, very, very severe downsides, and I think that's more visible today. His most recent book is The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. And he's written a bunch of other books. We'll be talking about all of that today on the show. He's also bringing in a special guest who will join us a little bit later in the conversation to give us some highlights of things going on in internationally in the Asia Pacific, because, you know, we kind of tend to be a little U.S.-centric, all of us Americans in our outlook. And her name is Kuhan Paik, and we'll be looking forward to speaking with her later in the show. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Jerry Mander. So happy to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be with you.
So, you know, let's just touch in a little bit with your early, incredible book. It was really prescient in terms of saying television, which kind of like looked at that time like a sort of benign entertainment, could wind up being a negative force in terms of cultural attitudes, beliefs, and economies. You know, what do you see from what you saw then and what you see today? If you could just give a little update progression on that, and I would also encourage our listeners to go back and read that book. It's very foundational.
Well, this event we just did in New York was actually, you know, a further evolution, you might say, of the arguments that were made in the television book. And the television book was really basically arguing that technology is not well enough, that we don't take into account the full picture when we talk about technology. We tend to talk about what is amusing or beneficial about it, or immediately helpful in some area, but without having a systemic picture of what the overall effects of technology are, and in the case of television, how it would entirely reorganize society, how it would become an instrument of speaking one set of values through to millions or billions of people and basically turning society into itself. Television is the first instrument that had the capability of speaking gigantic amounts of commercial imagery directly into the brains of billions of people and doing it all day long. And in the United States, it's an average of 4.5 hours a day. Even now, Americans watch 4.5 hours a day of television. That's even after computers came along. We all think everybody's doing computers, but nobody's watching television. That's not true. They're still doing 4.5 hours of television a day. That's the average person. And they're, mm-hmm. plus they're adding a whole lot of hours of computer time. So you have a whole society enveloped in receiving stuff from screen time. In the case of television, it's projected imagery directly into the brains. In the case of computers, it's complete connection with what's being offered from far away. And as a result, it changes people in a very profound ways, and it adds power to centralized corporate and political systems. And these are the greatest instruments for a unifying consciousness within a pre-desired commercial, capitalist, centralizing, alienating form. And the television book goes into great detail about that. And this event that we just had in New York covers a much wider range because it talks not only, television is just one of many technologies that are dealt with in this event, and the event is described as the event was called techno-utopianism and the fate of the earth. The idea that we, as a society, put so much faith in technology that we count technology as the way to save all the problems of the planet. And then what technology is causing problems, what we need really to solve it is more technology to solve it. And this is a completely backwards approach and doomed to failure. So it was a very broad range of technologies we were discussing. Nuclear, of course, is the most obvious, and all kinds of energy technologies. But things like nanotechnology, which is basically the redesign of the molecular structure of the planet, and to solve climate change, the whole idea is to geoengineer the skies. So it's another grand moment for technology to build new skies. And we're designing new people through synthetic biology and new food through GMOs and basically taking over the traditional functions of the planet in favor of having corporate and technological solutions. And something like that can work on a small scale from time to time, but what's happening is that the whole planet is being remade, human beings are being remade, and we're basically assuming power over all of life and all of the evolutionary system and over the planet and over the history of nature, you might say. And this is going to kill us. I mean, we already see what's happening in the world, you know, the fantastic amount of destruction that's already been. The oceans are dying, the skies are being you know, climate change is happening, the great extinction is coming on, the food supply is running out, the water supply is running out, the oceans are completely being destroyed, and we're at one of the most dangerous moments in all of history, and we're really not looking at the causes of it. The real causes of it are our dedication to corporate, commercial, technological evolution without any controls and without any discussion. So this event was really for the purpose of putting all this on the table. I don't think we came up with final solutions, but what we were trying to do is alert everybody that there is a new danger in town. There's a new set of concepts that we have to learn how to deal with, and it's time we got organized about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the program did that very, very powerfully. Thank you. That's just an incredible overview. So, you know, it's like if the choice is stepping back, and I'll use an example that will be very familiar to the listeners of this program, if the choice is stepping back from a climate-changing technology like fossil fuel use or a polluting technology, which is part of that, like fracking, which I've covered extensively, instead of stepping back from polluting the limited waters of the Earth or from kind of, you know, conjiggering with the gene pool of the food system, you know, of the food supply, which is another topic we've covered here, or, you know, stepping back from fossil fuel use in order to slow the destabilization of the living systems ecology of the whole planet. Instead of kind of saying, no, let's take a step back, let's go toward renewables, let's build up local farming economies and support that, you know, let's do other things that could be, I mean, it's both more resilient and more in keeping with what has traditionally been done on Earth. There's a kind of wholesale rejection or lack of valuing of that in favor of maintaining these corporate profit structures.
Well, it's stepping back from a worldview. When I talked at the teach-in, I started off with a very, very mini, incredibly over-accelerated history of the evolution of our attitudes about technology. I basically started from the Second World War and how we, at that time, the technological advancement was very, 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 very minor compared to what we have today. And it's been ramped up through the World's Fair and through billions and billions and billions and billions worth of advertising to tell people to view the world and view nature in a certain kind of way and to put primary benefits on the virtues of technology. And most of these technologies are developed, and the only technologies that really get developed are those that are profitable for corporations or else for the military. Now, Kuhan Pak will be on in a little while, and she can tell you more about how much of this technology that we use today was originally developed for military purposes and then adapted by corporations for commercial purposes, and that these are the driving forces of the system, and all of advertising is there to help us accept and engage and desire the worldview that satisfaction in life and peace and security and pleasure and happiness are all derived from whether we have the appropriate technology or not. And it's for us to argue that that's wrong, you know, that peace and security through that mode is not leading to happiness, and that we have to reconsider the whole set of structures. And we had a lot of indigenous people at this conference, Allison, as you know, so they were talking about a worldview that existed not very long ago in most parts of the world in which none of that came into play, and people were a lot happier. And if you've looked at recent statistics on happiness, we know that the United States, which is the most highly developed country in the world, is something like 56th in the world in terms of happiness levels, and that this is a very important reality, that this immersion in screen time and spending our lives related to machines and gathering our images from television and from other projections of commercial society, and developing robotics, and which is eliminating jobs and putting everyone completely on the machine, engaged with the machine, is not a way to get people to be happy. There's a whole other thing involved with direct communication and non-alienation and living with nature and experiencing oneself as alive that is really what happiness turns out to be about. And I think indigenous people and indigenous cultures have a lot better handle on that than these highly technologized societies that we utopianize.
You know, I'll just step in on my little hobby horse here as a 25-year health journalist, which is that this is also how we view our bodies, our beings, our living systems.
Right.
You know, we're a living system within our microcosm within the larger macrocosm of the larger living system, and we've become alienated from our own health and our sensations and our being by the mechanistic reductive science of modern medicine, which
right.
Which is another industrial technology. It isolates a particular biochemical action, enacts that through a profitable offering, a pharmaceutical drug or something else. And then there are all kinds of systemic impacts, which we call side effects, because we, the very science in which we look at finding, patenting, producing, and profiting from something that has a particular mechanism of action, by its very definition, fails to look at the whole, at the system, at all of the different impacts and effects, that are engendered by it.
Right.
So
you know,
that's very core to how we see ourselves, actually.
And we had a panel at the teach-in, mm-hmm. Specifically about it was called cyber envelopment and human awareness, and it was about the envelopment of human beings now by cyber technology and the degree to which we're connected to computers and iPhones, and you can barely walk down the street without bumping into people looking at their phones, and how the amount of screen time that people are living in, and this comes on top of the television time that they're already spending, but the degree to which people are going outside of themselves and relating to stuff that's coming from very far away and really not being where they are. Sherry Turkle wrote a great book called Alone Together, meaning that all this, you might be communicating with somebody far away, but you're alone while you're doing it. And the degree to which we have become alienated from all this tight engagement with technology is people are just beginning to become aware of that, I think. I think many people talk about that now. And another person we invited to our event is named Nicholas Carr, who's written several very, very good books, and basically describing that the increased engagement with computers is making people not only alienated but dumber, because their experience is completely confined to what they can get through one system of receiving information rather than from the full sensory and multifaceted systems that you experience prior to that time. And it's a shift that we've just begun to notice, but it's going to have tremendous consequences in the long run.
It also makes us even more prey to what you were describing in your television book, which is that then we become programmable.
Exactly,
all of the content
that's
coming
right.
there defines the nature of the debate. And so Vandana Shiva was mentioning at the conference, and she's the incredible global food pioneer, and really keeping us back close to and understanding the true traditional food systems of the earth and why they need to be honored in the face of GMO technology and all of those other things. So she was making the point that, basically when you capture an audience in that kind of way, you can, the media or the PR and all the rest of it can define the debate. And so they can make what she calls fictional statements like GMOs are needed to feed the world, when the reality on the ground is that's not actually what's happening. And yet many people captured in that way that you describe will come to believe that, or at least they'll think that's, the terms of what is debated will also be narrowed with people taking sides and the same kind of divisions and sort of back and forth that we see in political life. We see around a range of issues that are really important for sustaining life on Earth, like food.
Right.
And they've defined the argument, and that happened because they also, they're channeling that right into, and then people come to believe that.
That's why at this event we tried very hard to develop some new what we might call new attitudes about technology. I mean, this is just, you know, getting a bunch of people together for 2 days, even with 50 very, very powerful, good speakers, you can only begin to scratch the surface, because you can just begin to sort of say, hey, let's look at this, or hey, let's look at that, but you can't really come up with any final, or, you know, you don't mm-hmm. remake society from one meeting like that. But I think we did get somewhere in terms of developing new ways of thinking about technology. In other words, right now, we tend to accept the visions of technology that are put out to us through media or through corporate aggressive behavior or through the whole consumer society pressure that we all live in and that we're all used to and are used to thinking about as our most satisfying directions. But there's some of the attitudes that were talked about at this event, you know, included things like we must assess technology before we accept it, and there has to be a process of doing that. In other words, it can't only be who does the better advertising or what stores are carrying the finest exposures of that new technology. We have to establish a precautionary principle where technology must be examined fully from A to Z so that the downside of it is given equal time to the upside. We can't only judge technology by how it benefits us personally. That is to say, we can drive a car around, and that may be fun and useful, but what are cars doing to the entire landscape? You know, what are the consequences of the existence of cars in terms of oil, in terms of coverage of the roads over everything, in terms of pollution and so on? And that technology, we tend to think of technology as neutral, that it has no intrinsic negative effects. And yet, you know, again, as with a car, it's not neutral. If you have cars, you have tremendous oil development. You have tremendous waste. If you have nuclear energy, you have dangerous poison that you've got to bury for 200,000 years and have a gigantic military in order to protect it. And you have to have consider the whole relationship of technologies to other technologies, the technological scaffolding, all the gigantic mining that's done in Africa on indigenous land to get lithium so you can power your cell phone. You know, it's there's so many, and the idea that once you have a technology, you can't say no to it anymore, that you have to keep using it. This is preposterous. So we really got to learn how to look for and emphasize negative aspects before we just buy into the whole new stream of technological innovation. You know, people think of, oh, that's being negative, but negativity is positive in the current context because it would help us avoid some very, very, very dangerous things that we then don't know how to get rid of. You know, all these tremendous new nanotechnologies and genetic engineering and new skies and, you know, we should have done this about the creation of plastic, for God's sakes, you know, or so many other kinds of things. Plastic is killing the oceans more than anything else is, and we should have realized the consequences of all this, and we should be thinking about what kind of alternative systems could we live in that would avoid most of these dangers. And everybody says, well, if you say anything like that, that means you're a communist or a socialist. Let me say, I am not a communist, and I'm not a socialist either. I'm just saying that I'm anti the direction that this particular system is going in, and I do think that capitalism has a lot to do with driving it this way. So it's time for us to come up with what I call a hybrid economics, a new economic set of standards and forms that will take us into a different direction and be more satisfying to human society. It doesn't mean you can't run your little grocery store or your little bookstore and make a little money on the side. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with what kind of operating system do we really want now, given the circumstances of the near death of the planet.
You know, those are such important and powerful questions. And yet, you know, it's poignant for me because when I hear you introducing, you know, the precautionary principle, you know, the precautionary principle was, argued, a couple of decades back. And, you know, we haven't been very successful at introducing it as any kind of model, sadly. In fact, I'm doing writing on this very topic right now because, we have 250,000 toxic chemicals that haven't been studied. They've just been kind of allowed into use.
Right.
The point. Basis for using GMOs is basically studies by the producer.
By the corporations.
By independent
right.
scientists. And I think that what happens with people, because I'm constantly in social media and talking, engaging with people around all of this, is that people feel, the very point you say that we need, to have the right to evaluate, to feel that we can stop or say no or put a pause or study in advance. There's no advanced studying of the impacts of fracking waste, hazardous waste on
right.
water supplies
exactly.
and all.
Mm-hmm.
All of that, we don't have any of that. And so what happens with people is I think they feel overwhelmed and they don't see the mechanisms for getting a handle on this, and so they give up. And I hear that over and over and over. So what are the
right.
mechanisms for people, for us, for citizens, for the humans on Earth? What are our likeliest mechanisms for trying to get a handle on some of this?
Well, that's what we need a lot of work on, because mm-hmm. I don't think there is a ready mechanism. No,
mm-hmm.
If socialism were able to just step in and solve that problem, it would be one thing. But I think there are a lot of problems with socialism that make it difficult. But I do think we can start with certain principles. For
mm-hmm.
example, in our event, we listed some of the ingredients that we should look for in a new system. For example, we put the primacy of scale, not large scale, small scale systems, not global systems, local systems. Not to move faster, but to move slower. Not more, but less. Not top-down, bottom-up. Not privately owned, but shared, in many cases. Not investor-owned, community-owned. Not more technology, less technology. Not meta-economics, micro-economics. Not competitive, collaborative. Not more trade, less trade, and on and on. So we had a long list of ideas that could be the beginning point of discussions, but there's not a single thing I just listed here which any corporation would agree with. We're encapsulated or any of the governments that we're used to, any United States government would agree with those, because the current capitalist framework is the exact opposite of that and requires growth at all costs, requires more consumption, not less consumption, is built on hierarchy, has no moral connection, and it tries to control from a centralized point the entire operations of the system, and needs to use more energy, not less energy. So it's a real face off, but it's very important that we at least articulate some of the ingredients of a new system, so we can begin to figure out what is possible and what we can do, at least have something sensible to talk about. Right now, I mean, even in the Occupy movement, you mm-hmm. rarely saw from the occupiers a clear articulation. In fact, I love the Occupy movement, and I went to their demonstrations and I spoke for them and so on. But they didn't have a worked out set of principles, and they should have had, or they should have started working together. That should have been one of their functions, was to work out set of principles so that people would have some image of where things needed to go and how things needed to be organized, and as well as a critique of technology. I was just invited to an event in South America where a bunch of people want to discuss new economics, and I may go, I may not go, I don't know, it's a couple months from now, I'm really too tired to think about it, but they left technology completely out of the list of things that they wanted to discuss. To me, that was just shocking, to not realize the role of technology and also the history of technology, the relationship of technology to corporate power, the relationship of technology to military power, the relationship of technology to the consequences on the earth. That's all been left out of that meeting that's being contemplated in South America. And so I don't know whether I'll go to that or not, but if I do go, I'm going to bring this all up and say, how could you leave this stuff out? So we have to get clear on the ingredients of change and the kinds of things that need to get talked about if we're going to succeed at all.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically what you're articulating. You're articulating personally, and also, you know, the International Foundation Forum on Globalization as well, with the teach-in and your ongoing activities. We're coming up on a break here on Connect the Dots. I just want to mention before we go into the break, and I'll mention it again after the break, that many of these excellent talks to which we're referring in this conversation are going to be available via some form of video streaming on the website. They're not up yet. I checked, and I will be keeping...
It'll be a few weeks before they're up.
Right, and I'll mention it in an upcoming show.
Right.
So let's take our five-minute break for station identification now. Please stay with us, listeners, for this fantastic conversation, talking with Jerry Mander, and we'll bring you the second half of the show and the deepening conversation as we proceed. Stay with us. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and this is the second half of a wonderful conversation I'm having with Jerry Mander today, co-founder of the International Forum on Globalization. And we're this is actually my very favorite kind of show, because on Connect the Dots, we kind of look at many different facets of the things that are going on in our world that impact our health personally, our community's health, our society's health, our global ecology and life on Earth. And this is really a very big picture look at the role of technology, systems, economics, with Jerry Mander, who's been an incredible pioneer in analyzing some of the forces that have shaped our modern world, our modern understanding, and the terrible dilemmas that we have created for ourselves and for life on Earth. So we'll be continuing that conversation. If you are coming back after listening to the first half of the show, thank you so much. Please do like us on iTunes and pass us along to others who you think would be really interested in hearing this exceptional insight of Jerry Mander's. If you're just tuning in, you can find the show later today in archives on the Connect the Dot Archives on the Progressive Radio Network website and listen to the whole show. So now we're returning to our conversation. You know, I also want to just mention also that next week we are going to be continuing, and it's now going to be, that'll put us out to 5 weeks of guests who were presenters at the recent teach-in, Techno-Utopia, that we've been discussing throughout the program. All of those talks will be available in a couple of weeks on the website of the International Forum for Globalization, which is ifg.org, and there's a header that says Techno-Utopia. You can keep in touch with it there. Next week, Helena Norbert Hodge, who is another speaker at the teach-in, will be joining us. And we'll be talking about the economics of happiness with her. So please do keep that in mind, too, and listen in again next week. So back to our conversation with Jerry. You know, I have to ask this question. I think you're right that, you know, if people have a sense of both where to go and also what's afflicting us, and that's really clarified, then in a way there's this kind of aha thing that makes it easier to face, easier to think about, easier to begin to look for solutions to. And they, you know, and it's not like an easy quick fix thing. All of this technology is quick fixes. You know, we think a quick fix, whether it's a pharmaceutical medicine or, you know, some gadget or building a new sky, as I learned about to my horror at the teach-in, you know, to deal with the fact that we're, you know, destabilizing our whole planet through climate change. You know, that's not exactly an easy quick fix at all, but, you know, there's a tendency to think that something outside ourselves will fix it, and it expresses a deep sense of disempowerment and disconnection that many people feel. And I think that a reason that a lot of people don't feel able to look at these problems, don't, you know, feel capable of addressing these issues, are kind of just overwhelmed and sort of trundling along, and, you know, I hope someone else solves it, I'm not really ready to participate. You know, part of it is this outsized nature, and I think that breaking it down, as you're doing, in terms of what the particular issues are, is super important. But I'd also, you know, to kind of helping people come out of the overwhelmed brain fog that many of us experience. You know, what do you think? Do you think social activism? Do you think economic? I mean, we're taught to sort of, you know, economic action. We're sort of taught to that our only source of of activity is to, you know, buy the right product or something. We've kind of been hypnotized. I mean, if you could restore people to a sense of empowerment and potential action to change some of this, you know, how would you do that? What would you say to them?
Well, that's that's the question. You know, how to empower people's actions, and also, you know, it's funny, in doing this event, I mentioned it at the teach-in, I received criticism. You know, it's like, you must be a Luddite to do this an anti-technology event. It's like they leap to, if I say there's a problem with some technology, then everybody's ready to call you a Luddite, because people are not used to, and by Luddite they mean somebody who hates all technology. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Luddites didn't hate all technology. The Luddites were a fantastic community of people who worked on a small scale on local economies, who produced their own products and who produced their own food for the most part. They engaged in a little bit of trade. This is 19th century England. And then all of a sudden, you know, the corporate system took over, and they were basically unable to continue to do what they were doing. They were forced to work in factories at miserable wages and under brutal conditions, and they revolted. And there was a Luddite, you know, there was a little bit of a revolution against the domination, the destruction of their very successful earlier artisanal systems, and the imposition of a large scale, top down technology driven, automated system. And they fought and fought and fought and lost. Actually, they won some small battles, but. So Luddite is a perfectly good thing to be called, except what they mean when they call me a Luddite is that I hate all technology, I'm against all technology. And at the teach-in, I pointed out that, you know, I came by airplane, I took a taxi to the thing, I talk on the telephone, as I'm doing with you, I use an old ratty computer, but I don't buy the whole picture, I don't buy the whole story, and I'm trying to do what we call a strategic embrace. You know, if we're going to be useful, we have to fight with the tools that we have available, or else we just have to retire and go off into the woods by ourselves. And I don't think that's going to help save the world. I think it's more important to save the world if we actually engage. And engagement is a difficult matter, because it's hard to engage in a political way when there hasn't been a political movement developed. Now, that's mm-hmm. what was so hopeful about the Occupy movement, because it seemed like there was going to be a political movement developing out of that. It didn't really work out. It was suppressed, actually, very actively suppressed by the powers that be, the police on the contact end. But it was certainly desirable for the corporate system and for the system itself to not let that protest continue. But what's really necessary is that we operate on several levels at once. You do have to examine your own habits. You do have to avoid buying and supporting institutions which are killing us. You know, if you can avoid your automobile, avoid it. If you can put everything on a smaller scale, that's better. If you're going to, you know, I mean, you have to make individual decisions about individual things. But that won't save the world. Because I don't think that everyone is going to do that. And so what's really necessary is to get organized together and to create movements. So our event was really in order to and to give it a political context and political importance. Now, I don't know. We need Martin Luther King for that, or somebody like that. I really don't know what to say in terms of the specifics of how we're going to do it. But meetings like we just had are a step in that direction. It's an effort to say, look, we've got this gigantic mess. Let's look at this part. 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 Let's see how we relate to it personally. Let's see how we relate to it politically. Let's see what the politicians are saying about it. Let's see how we can react to that. I mean, there's so many thousands of possible directions that really all you can do is just do what you can do and remain cognizant of the goal and not expect unrealistically of all kinds of miraculous victories in the short term, and realize that it's a gigantic, monstrous thing that we're up against, and that you do the best you can, and you also want to live your life and remain positive and have a good life and raise your kids and make enough money to live and keep in the society, but you also have to keep working where you can. So, I mean, really, I can't answer your question. Really, you just everybody has to do what they can do, and that's what's really, you have to get as informed as possible. You have to get hooked up as possible. You have to do personal things as much as you can. And when there's an opportunity to do broader things, do those. Mm-hmm. Is that a good enough answer?
That is a good enough answer. I think, you know, I mean, I think it's very real, and people struggle with this, and you're not offering a magic pill here, and there is
there's
not
no magic,
a magic pill.
Pill.
Right, 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 exactly.
I mean, we have to operate on personal terms. We have to operate in political terms. We have to operate in conceptual terms. You know, we have to deal, we have to realize that we have to reconstruct a system that avoids these pitfalls, and we have to figure out the ingredients of that system, and we have to know if that system that we're trying to design has got some of the flaws of the previous system that we're, and we have to get very, very, very knowledgeable about where things, what the problems are coming from, how they're rooted, and the elements of and the various impacts of the various parts of the system. I mean, it's just a, it's a big job. And, you know, we invited a couple of people to this event. I'm not going to name them because they've been heroes to a lot of people, but a couple of people who've been at it for quite a while who've kind of given up. And it's very disappointing to us, to the organizers of the event, that we weren't able to get them to come this time. But they said, you know, it's too late. And so I don't think it's too late. I don't think it's too late. It's definitely not too late because things are going to crash before too long. We're going to, you know, the effects of climate change are going to be really major. I love what Bill McKibben and the 350.org people are doing. We also had Ralph Nader at our event, as well as Bill, and you don't see any slowing down on his part, and I think that's great too. And I think all the people who are at the event are really absolutely dedicated to reforming the situation as it currently exists and identifying all the elements that need to be changed and then working to change them. You know, it's extremely important.
Mm-hmm. You know, now that you've had the teach-in and that's going to be disseminated, again, people can go to the ifg.org website where it says Techno-Utopia and check in a couple of weeks to listen to the extraordinary talks that were given there, really very inspiring. But what are the forward steps for your organization? Are you regrouping? Are you making future plans?
Right now the plan is to encourage our partners, the people who spoke, to continue their work, and we will try to find ways to reconvene and to organize the work into an effective mode and into a better plan. What we will do with the stuff from the teach-in is we're gonna first of all create an audio stream of everyone who spoke at the event, we're gonna create an audio stream so that people can listen at least to the voices as soon as that should be up within a couple of weeks. After that, we will have the actual speeches on our website, visual, so people can watch them from beginning to end. Every word has been recorded. We plan to do a book, a collection of the speeches, or at least an edited collection of the speech, I should say, not full length, 22 hours worth. We couldn't put that into the Bible, but it's like, as much of the good material as we can, and identify subject areas that we really need to get more knowledgeable. That's why I want Kuhan Pak to say a few things, because the military connection to all this is not generally appreciated, and so I think she should add a little bit. Is that all right with you?
Yes, it's fine. We have about another 10 minutes or so for the show. So
okay, good. Well,
but let's bring her in. I think it's a great point to bring her in and add that larger perspective to our conversation.
I think that's a part of it that people don't generally see as connected to the rest of it. Hang on.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Alice. So this is Kuhan.
Oh, hi, Kuhan. How are you? I saw that you were kind of everywhere at the event.
Oh, right. I wish I had gotten introduced, but yeah, I was pretty busy. Well, basically, I only heard Jerry's side because we're in a hotel room of the conversation. But I think one thing that people don't understand is that if it weren't for the arms race with Russia, of all things, we wouldn't have iPads, we wouldn't have Facebook, we wouldn't have Google Glass, Google Earth, we wouldn't have robot vacuum cleaners, we wouldn't have video games, we wouldn't have apps, we wouldn't have any of that, because all of that stuff was funded, the technologies of all those applications were funded during the Reagan Star Wars era. All the people that developed those technologies were getting their PhDs in computer science at MIT and Carnegie Mellon. They went on to open all these companies that do that. In the meantime, the technologies they developed, like drones, like satellite technology, well, Star Wars was being able to shoot somebody with a drone while you were, like, in your living room or playing a video game in your office in Virginia, somebody in Pakistan's wedding was getting exploded by a drone. Those are the technologies that were left with the Pentagon while the people who developed them went on to develop consumer applications for these. And I think that's really important because it is their digital quality that enables the level of totalitarian control to which military minds aspire. And there are inherent qualities in digital technologies. One is its complete eradication of time and space, which are the very boundaries that have kept humans in check in terms of what it can do to demolish nature. And the other is the complete disappearance of memory.
Mm.
I don't know if you saw that video that we showed. It was an interview with the editor of Wired magazine in England, and he said, people say, oh, you've lost your memory. Well, yeah, it's true, but I don't care. I don't care that I can't remember anything anymore. I mean, the guy can't be more than 40, and yet his memory capacity is like somebody with, like, late-stage dementia. And he says,
It's all on the internet. I downloaded
my memory to my mobile device, so why do I need a memory? I think those people are trivial to make a point out of that. Well, the thing that concerns me is when you've lost your capability for personal memory, you've lost your capability for historical and cultural memory, who your people are, where you come from. And this is very concerning. I'm part Jewish, so, you know, we've always had it drummed into us that the history repeats itself and never forget your history. Well,
yes.
with the advent of digital devices, there's no more history. And it's great because now you go into Times Square and you see an enormous Apple icon and that becomes the new swastika. So this, I find it extremely troubling, and because there are inherent properties to digital technology that are inherently totalitarian and just very destructive to human culture and to the planet, because that does not play into the equation of what these technologies are about.
That's so fascinating. So that very new shininess, you know, that super clean, you know, like, let's make it, even the fact that, you know, one of the reasons that I love this show and, it, you know, the guests and listeners tell me they love this show is that we're having a real human conversation on the show. And it's enough of a long conversation to be an in-depth conversation. And it's, you know, quirky. I sometimes mispronounce the name of the organization, God help me, or the book or whatever. It has that, you know, kind of flawed human thing. We can kind of think aloud together.
Radio is just the most wonderful medium.
Yeah, but some of these other things, you know, you've got to get a slick phrase. It has to be perfect. It's all stripped down like a, you know, every, you know, like a branch where only one leaf kind of remains, because that's all. And then our capacity to digest or integrate more complex areas of life, you know, that are part of our whole being, subjective things that really aren't even put into words very well, or feelings that we have, all of these other kinds of things are kind of left at the gate in favor of this kind of packaged, perfected, shiny
version. Right, pre-done, pre-packaged, not on the fly, not live. And also that's what I also love about call-in shows also, because the whole community can engage.
Yes, they're wonderful.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to develop that aspect here, but we haven't quite brought it off yet. But, that's fantastic.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'll hand you back to Jerry now.
Okay, well, lovely talking to you. And
nice
I'd love
your
whole outlook on everything. Maybe we'll have you back again. We'd love that.
Okay, yeah, anytime. Thanks.
All right, great. Thanks.
Hi, Allison.
Hi. That was terrific.
Good.
You know, what I really loved in what she was saying, and we only have a few more minutes here, but is the fact when she called it totalitarian, it's actually, there's something stylistically, culturally, intellectually that is overly simplified about the things that play well and go mass in these media technologies that does have a kind of mind control totalitarian potential, shall we say, to it. No one ever mentions that. I think it's really interesting.
Good.
Any comments on that yourself in terms of your...
It's a totalitarian system, of course. Yes, she's absolutely right, because we are living inside mm-hmm. a set of frameworks mm-hmm. In terms of employment, basically survival, our economic viability as individuals and communities, our choices in terms of culture, are all framed by institutions that require a certain mode of behavior in order for them to profit and become dominant in the system. And when they become dominant in the system, they find forms to use that are going to continue and enabling them to remain dominant, just as the military has done and just as corporations have done. And our entire political process now is subservient to those two institutions, to corporations, capitalism, and the military are basically the dominant forces in our society. Well, you know, where was that written that it should be that way? We have a so-called constitution which is supposed to be democratic and everybody gets engaged in it, and it absolutely doesn't work that way because we have what amounts to a totalitarian arrangement. The only things that really fly, I mean, you and I might be able to get together and open a coffee shop someplace, but if we want to have any effect on the way the whole system operates and whether or not we're going to kill the oceans and kill the sky and kill native people in Africa, you know, that's all up to somebody else. They've got it all worked out already. Their system is dominant, and you could call it totalitarian very, very well. I think that's an excellent word for it.
So, in fact, this kind of goes back, we only have about two more minutes here, but this goes back to the question I asked you earlier, which is why do people feel so disengaged and helpless and disempowered? And in effect, what you're saying, or what could be implied by what you're saying, is that because on some level we know this, and we're scared, and we're kind of going along with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right. That's a very good way of putting it. You know, I think most people kind of recognize all this, mm-hmm. but what are they going to do about it? You know, that was what's always great about the Occupy movement, in that it had an apparent thing you could do. I think it was inadequate. I loved the Occupy movement because I thought it was a first great expression in my recent years, anyway, mm-hmm. of people who were trying to do something about it. But they didn't carry it far enough, and I don't want to be critical about it. But I mean, I think they were up against a lot, and the system recognized them as potential very dangerous if it grew and really got its toes into the ground, you might say. So I think that it's very, very difficult for people to do this, and that's why I say that we have to keep open a multiplicity of choices for ourselves in terms of what we do. We do the immediate thing. We don't buy the crappy product from the crappy corporation if we can avoid it. We don't do the thing that we know is destructive if we can avoid it. We try to be selective in our activities and our purchases if we can. We try to have a job which is positive for nature rather than negative if we can. We do the best mm-hmm. we can. And then if there's a movement emerging somewhere or if it's a way to express ourselves in a broader form, such as coming to a teach-in like that, which we had, 600 people all together, I think, came. So it was, that's something. And then we're going to try to do more to make it possible to take advantage of what was done at that event and move it forward. But it's a, it's a long-term process, and I think it is a totalitarian framework.
Thank you, Jerry. We're coming, as we can hear by the music, to the end of our time together. Thank you so much for appearing on the
program.
Not
at all. Thank you. Thanks for doing these shows.
Yeah. And thank you, listeners. Come back next week at 10 a.m. Eastern for our next Connect the Dots. We'll be talking with another of the speakers at Jerry Mander and the International Forum on Globalization's teach-in event. That will be Lena Norbert Hodge. Thank you for being with us this week and wishing everyone well.